Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Ian's Health Podcast. In this edition, I'll be talking with Matt Whitmore and Kerry Marsden, health and fitness professionals based in London. They run the company Fitter London, and they are the authors of the book Fitter Food. Guys, I'm really grateful for you coming in and speaking to us today, so thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us, mate.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Matt, Kerry, what's the story so far? You know, are you able to give us some background on how you've arrived at this point and how you've developed your views on health, wellness and nutrition?
To be honest with you, I've kind of come from quite a sporting background. You know, I've always participated in like football. I've played rugby at a good standard, always been active, always loved training and always been lean. However, just because I was lean, my diet used to be absolutely atrocious. I suppose I was one of those typical guys who just thought, because I'm lean and I train and I play sport, I can eat whatever the hell I want. And whilst I still ate, you know, somewhat kind of like healthy meals, you know, when I was living at home, pizza, KFC, McDonald's, chocolate, Coca-Cola, I used to drink 2 litres of Dr. Pepper every day. And that was absolutely standard for me. And I could kind of say that ignorance is bliss. And for a long time, I was incredibly ignorant because, like I said to you, I was active and I was lean, so I didn't see it as being a problem. And then kind of over the years, as I was kind of educating myself a little bit more and I became a personal trainer and became a little bit more clued up with what I was doing, but I was still kind of fell into that category of, you know, I can eat whatever the hell I want. And it wasn't until I met Kerris, really, who kind of like, she kind of like showed me the way, so to speak. And she'll tell you a little bit more about this when she kind of gives her intro. And, you know, I was eating like 12 to 15 slices of bread a day, tons of milk, tons of pasta, lots of ready meals, things like that, just to kind of keep me going. I was working long hours.
And you were able to stay quite lean doing that, Matt?
Yeah, because I trained a lot, you know. I trained like most days and, you know, I was very active. You know, some days I'd train twice because I'd do like weights in the day and then I'd have rugby in the evening.
Right, so pretty decent kind of genetics to begin with and obviously yeah. an active lifestyle.
Yeah, definitely.
I'd say genetically, yeah.
Not many people could get away with that now.
No, well, the weird thing is I could probably still get away with it now from a body comp point of view.
Yeah.
From a health perspective, I definitely couldn't get away with it. Because even back then, you know when you kind of don't know any different?
Yeah.
So for me, bloating was normal because, you know, you just get bloated after meals. That's how I looked at it. You fart a lot. You know, that was normal. You have a massive energy crash in the afternoon. I thought, well, everyone has an energy crash in the afternoon. That's because I've been up early. Yet when you then do change things and you start to realize that actually – being bloated isn't normal, having low energy isn't normal, etc. It starts to make you look at things in a very different way. And it was Kerris who kind of started to kind of, I won't say nag.
Totally nag.
She did nag me.
Yeah.
But to be fair, it must have been infuriating for her because I was making all these really poor nutritional choices and then, you know, moaning about how I was tired, I was bloated, you know, just had no energy, etc. And over time, like my training started to suffer. I used to break out in spots quite a lot. And Kerris was quite big at the time on like a paleo based diet. And I figured, well, you know what? I can't keep kind of like moaning about all these things and not give this a try. So I just kind of went for it and I kind of read up on it a little bit more. And I cut out the bread, the pastas. I was just eating a lot of meat, veg and fish. I was getting carbs in the way of potatoes and stuff, so I wasn't going too low carb. And at first, I'm not going to lie to you, I felt horrendous.
Right, yeah.
I had massive like withdrawals from like the sugar and whatnot because I cut all the crap out. I cut all the processed stuff out. I was still eating plenty of food.
I was going to say, do you think you were still eating the same volume from a calorie? Not that I'm overly fussed about calorie numbers.
To be honest, I probably wasn't.
Yeah.
Consuming as many calories because my diet before was so calorie dense because I was eating so many processed foods that I'd definitely say that I was consuming a lot less calories. Hence the reason why I did lean up a little bit further. I mean, I was already quite lean and I could see myself getting a bit leaner. But for 5 days, I think the best way to describe how I felt was I felt like I had a 5-day hangover.
Yeah.
you know, I felt like I'd been on a massive night out, but unfortunately I hadn't. And I had a banging headache, low energy, felt quite sick, really not dehydrated, but I felt really, yeah. I felt thirsty all the time, dry mouth.
You're really selling it.
No, but it is
actually quite interesting though, because it's worth pointing out, because people, your automatic assumption when you change something and you feel so rough, like you said you did, I mean, you will have been so overly reliant on these products beforehand that when you then felt so rough, people think your natural reaction is, well, this can't be healthy for me, yeah, if I feel, yeah, this bad. And yeah, you know, I mean, I suppose the analogy I give to people is, you know, people don't feel particularly well when they're coming off heroin either, but, you know, that's the right thing to do. So
this is very true. You know, so I've heard.
Add that clause. Yeah.
But it's like, I even said it to Kerry, so I was like, what the hell? Like, this, I feel horrendous. This can't be doing me any good. But she was like, no, hang fire. And I kind of like looked it up and everywhere was saying, you know, kind of ride it out. And day six, I woke up 30 minutes before my alarm went off. Full of energy, just got straight out of bed, felt absolutely phenomenal, had loads of energy all day long, literally right up until bedtime, and I slept like an absolute baby. And I just thought, God, I don't think I've ever felt like this in my life. I felt so good. And that was kind of the biggest turning point for me, because that feeling of feeling so amazing lasted a long, long time. And I thought, God, like, I don't ever want to feel how I felt before. And like I said to you, that was the turning point for me, where I really genuinely experienced the benefits, the true benefits, to just eating a more natural diet most of the time. You know, it's not as if we're complete angels, are we? You know, and a bit of ice cream creeps in here and there, and I might have the odd bit of cake and chocolate and whatnot. But the difference is whereas before that would have been a daily occurrence for me, and that's no exaggeration, you know, like a Snickers bar mid-morning, yeah, no problem.
Yeah.
Whereas now I might have a Snickers bar once in a, you know, once every few months, if that. And, you know, and it just works for me now. You know, like you talk about the kind of 80-20 rule, or I'd say I'm a little bit more 90-10, yeah, maybe. Yeah. But you know, I don't in any way deprive myself. And, you know, as you know, we've got our book, and that's partly why we wrote our book, was to kind of show people that eating really good quality nutrient-dense meals doesn't need to be boring, and it doesn't need to take up, you know, half of your life cooking all the time. It is actually a lot easier than people think. So, yeah, in a nutshell, that's me. I used to be shockingly bad. Kerry showed me the way, and now I've found that balance that works for me.
I think one of the important points you made is, I think when I'm trying to explain to people what they should be doing and advocating a certain way of living, is I don't think they ever appreciate what they could feel like. Like, I think the norm has become, like you've just said, being bloated, not feeling at 100%, but they don't know they're not 100%. They think what they like is normal, and then it's only when they can make, you know, what will be quite a big change for most people, is that they can appreciate, like you've just said, 5-6 days, maybe could be longer, could be short for some people, of going through a bit of a nightmare to get to a point. But once you've got to the point, there's not really any going back, is there? And I don't think people ever, most people, when they're doing some kind of health kick or whatever they're doing, they don't get to that point. And so therefore they always think it will be a battle, and no one's prepared to battle forever, but they don't realise that it won't be. And I think that's one of the challenges, of, you know, you may face. I know I face it with people when I'm trying to, what's the word, you know, trying to get them on side. So, but yeah, it's interesting that you said that you went through that, and body composition, like I said, wasn't an issue for you anyway, which is quite interesting that you've gone through it and done it when, like I said, you had to be shown the way. But for most people, body composition is the main motivator for them to be a certain way, isn't it, really? And health's kind of a little bit of a second thing, but a nice little add-on for them. But for a lot of people, it's looking the part, isn't it? I don't know whether you find that, but I certainly do.
Yeah, we have, most, I'd say like 80 to 90% of people who approach us, it's all about losing body fat. That's their main goal. And we have to coach them a little bit on actually sort of transforming their vision into a bit more health orientated, because often, even when you sort of start your journey, you sort of need to be able to know when your body's feeding back that maybe your nutrition and your lifestyle isn't quite working. And that's not always about body fat, as Matt's proven. You know, you can use skin and digestive health and energy and hormones and all sorts of other ways that you can sort of measure whether you're going down the right path or maybe it needs refining a little bit. And then we've actually, some people we work with, rather than do what we did, what I did with Matt, Matt's basically like my test bed. So he gets to do everything hardcore. But with clients, some of them, we might do more step change. So it might just be like, let's just change breakfast first, because, you know, most people aren't having what we would consider to be a nutritious breakfast, yeah, realistically, and probably haven't for most of their life. Yeah. So, yeah, we try and switch people back to protein-based breakfast and increase fats up, you know, bump fats up a little bit. But there's this massive educational process that has to happen, and we have to change people's fears almost, don't we? We have to work really hard to explain. And obviously, you must find this when you're a personal trainer, people like believe you, but they also have a slight distrust because you're not a doctor and you're not a sort of, you know, necessarily a professional, you know, dietitian.
And they think you were born a certain way as well. Like, especially like someone like Matt, I imagine will find it, you know, yourselves, when people look at you and think, they think you've never had any kind of battle.
Yeah. Also, I would say, I don't know about you, Matt, but when we were, Matt actually convinced me, I was working actually for the food industry and studying nutrition. He's the one that convinced me, because I was so passionate about it, to leave and become a personal trainer, because I was just sort of a bit of a weekend warrior, wasn't I? Yeah. Anything. So I left my job and we launched a company together. And I would say being a personal trainer was the biggest challenge on my health ever because of the hours, yeah, that you have to put in. And it was exhausting. We were 7 days a week. We were up at 5. You didn't get home till 9, 10 o'clock. All of your food has to be prepped in advance. You know, because you're sort of eating in between clients and things like that. So I only lasted, about 2 years, and hats off to anyone that does it, you know, for decades, because even you did it longer than I did. Yeah. But it is, I think, it's a really tough career to go into. You've got to be very passionate about it to stick it out.
Yeah, you have to have a certain set of conditions. I mean, I've sort of, in my own personal situation, mine changed dramatically when I had a child. So, and it's definitely not a game for someone with a small child when you have to be, you know, otherwise you would never see them. yeah, these things, you know, you guys will find that out, I'm sure. But it is quite a challenge, like you said. I think probably the thing that helps us, if we're in that gym environment, is certainly we're able to do our exercise and this, that, and the other, which I think probably one of the hard things for people is after they've done a day's work, it's getting to the gym. Because I don't know what you feel like, but I find if I'm sort of, the more active I am in my work, I'm able to do my exercise. Whereas if I was sort of doing a more stationary role, I find that quite tiring. Which is a bit, it's different, isn't it? You know, I'm not physically moving as much, but yeah, I find it quite tiring, and I find less motivated to do my exercise then than if I am moving around and doing, you know, your typical personal trainer type role. So yeah, I appreciate it is a different kind of challenge for people. And like you said, Kerris, that the PT role is something different again, you know, doing many, many hours or spread over a long set of hours, isn't it, really, I guess?
Well, we always say that doing nothing's absolutely knackering.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like you say, if you've been sat down glued to a laptop all day, you finish, your energy levels are through the floor, and the last thing you want to do is drag yourself to the gym and work up a sweat, you know what I mean?
But yeah, it's like that mental fatigue, isn't it, I think, that obviously is obviously quite big, I think, in rather than a physical tire, you know, I think that's it.
Isn't it ironic, though, that a lot of people who, we've always said that nowadays people are getting more and more sedentary, yet eating more energy dense foods.
Exactly.
And it's almost a bit like, hold on a minute, something's not right here. You know, you're moving less and you're eating more calories, you're eating more energy, but something's not quite right. This needs to change. And that's the hardest thing, because people are glued to their laptops, you know, because they've got no energy. They're constantly on the hunt for their next glucose hit just to kind of tie them over for the next hour or two. And whereas, you know, if they just made some really simple adjustments to their nutrition, like Kerris said, starting their day with a better breakfast, maybe getting off the bus or the train one stop early, whatever it may be, and then walking a little bit, getting a bit of fresh air on your lunch break as well, you know, those are two very, very simple changes, but could have a huge impact on, you know, kind of like the average kind of 9-to-5 office worker, for example.
Yeah. So would you say then, I was going to say to both of you probably actually, would you say therefore then, would you blame that as the issue for the problem we've got now? So, you know, it's a massive number of people that are overweight or obese. And I know what I think has sort of caused the issue, but would you say it is, like you've just said, Matt, lot people eating energy dense foods, which are generally nutrient light, and not doing as much, and rather than, or would you say it's something more like, Kerish, you might actually want to answer this in terms of the public health situation. Would you say it's the advice we've been given?
Do you know what, we've been doing a little bit of some presentations on this recently, and I just think it's so many different factors, and we've said it's a sort of a combination of generally, you know, being obese or overweight is a combination of your genes, so looking at your parents' and grandparents' health is quite significant, combined with your environment, which is your nutrition and the amount of physical exercise, even right down to nutrient deficiencies can be, you know, sort of not a causing factor, but associated with obesity. So if we start to lack certain minerals like magnesium and zinc and B vitamins, which are a really important part of our metabolism, because we don't eat the foods that have them in, or we eat a lot of foods that block their absorption, then we're, you know, we can find that these sort of chronic diseases are all basically escalating out of control. And one thing that we sort of do is not only point people back towards nutrient-dense foods, but actually doing their own cooking and sourcing their own food, so that if you look now, everything mostly in a supermarket, restaurant or food outlet has to have preservatives, additives, and they want to make a profit, so there's going to be some bulk added somewhere. So they're sort of, you know, what we call nutritional toxins, or Matt just calls them fake foods.
Yeah, garbage, yeah.
Yeah, basically. And the food industry has to make a profit. That's what it wants to do. And when you're cooking at home, you're obviously not. So you tend to be more focused on freshness and taste. And so you put good stuff in, and you're just going to experience better results. But and I suppose the other side of it, I'd say, is we are so focused now on, as kids as well, having medications like antibiotics, which are now quite strongly being linked to body composition issues, because that again is where you would break down you break down your nutrients in the gut, and that's part of your metabolism. So if you were, I know I was on antibiotics for most of my teens for acne, and that's when I sort of started to notice that I was gaining weight, you know, probably a combination of factors, you know, as I was getting older, I couldn't get away with chocolate bars on the way to school and stuff, but that's a big factor, and the way that you're born these days, you know, even cesarean birth and things like that, just means that we have a different gut sort of profile, and if you don't feed that throughout life with lots of live foods and fruit and vegetables, then you could just be in trouble later.
It's becoming quite a big thing, that the sort of the microbiome, they call it, don't they, the effect of the gut on your health, and something like antibiotics, which if we're honest have been massively overprescribed in sort of the past, you know, they would just decimate your gut bacteria, and you know, what would you do from there? I mean, the life, you know, nothing to be taken away, they're absolutely life-saving antibiotics, and we'd probably be in a poorer situation without them, or as in there'd be more people dying of acute infections, but in terms of long-term chronic sort of disease, they're probably making a contribution there, wouldn't you say?
No, definitely. And I think people are getting a bit wise to it. And doctors are now saying, if you take antibiotics, do follow up with a course of probiotics. And I know in America, which is always seems to be a bit sort of more advanced medically than we are, they're now testing, if you go in with an ear infection, they're testing the strain of bacteria to try and match the right antibiotic to that bacteria, rather than just sort of, you know,
broad spectrum,
yeah. Yeah, people will go and have these, they sort of carpet bomb the entire body with just, let's just try and wipe out everything. And for some people, like I said, this can be months and years, and it's a long journey back from that. And there is a bit of a, but then equally, I've been to conferences with a lot of GPs who've said, try being on the other side of the fence, where people walk into a surgery and almost demand a tablet nowadays. They want something and won't leave until they have it. So You know, there's sort of, I think it's going to be a difficult situation to get out of in that sense. A lot of education needed, and there's a lot of and that's got to go to schools and to and sort of NHS to start talking to people about a healthier diet, really.
Yeah, I guess, well, Western medicine, I suppose, is set up and is very good at dealing with acute issues, isn't it? You know, so if something's bleeding or something needs to be cut off, or there's some you know, acute issue right then it does very well. We're a bit poorer, and we're a bit more reactive on the chronic conditions, aren't we? So like you've just said, the reaction is to look at what medication can we prescribe, or rather than what can we do to prevent this happening.
Well, that's the key, isn't it? The key word you just said there was prevent, and it's so funny, like people would rather wait until, you know, shit hits the fan before they actually do anything about it, you know, and that's something that we're really big on, and we've got a few projects this year that we're working on, that it's all about prevention, you know. So, you know, rather than focusing on the cure or you know, dealing with something once it's in full effect, you know, what about working on preventing it in the first place? And we was having this conversation the other day with someone about an anti-cancer diet, because obviously cancer rates are going up and up and up, you know, as well as a lot of other kind of you know, diseases like heart disease, diabetes, things like that. You know, they're skyrocketing. Yet there's probably millions of pounds going into all these like cancer research campaigns, asking for people's money to help them find a cure, so to speak. Yet, you know, there's absolutely nothing out there to talk about prevention. And we were talking about, you know, anti-cancer diets. And the truth is, generally, there is no such thing as an anti-cancer diet per se, because it kind of just ties in with generally just eating nutrient-dense, single-ingredient foods most of the time, you know, and getting a variety of nutrients in there, such as, you know, different sources of proteins, fats, carbohydrates, and just rotating them. And essentially, that is an anti-cancer diet. It's an anti-diabetes diet. It's an anti-obesity diet, you know. And
Alzheimer's is now coming out with
I think probably people think it's a done deal, don't they? So I think people think, you know, that they're it's predetermined whether they're going to get cancer or not, or there's not an awful lot they can do about it, like I said. But I mean, as people know, for example, obesity pretty much increases your chances of anything bad happening to you. So therefore, if you can start to alter your body to not be in that situation, surely, you know, you're going to help everything with that, you know, cancer being one of those.
We always say even like the extremes of everything are going to drive you towards disease. Like, so it's interesting you said about, you know, healthy body composition is definitely a goal. And if you're too sedentary, you're going to have repercussions. But also if you're too active, you know, you're now seeing, you know, I love that people are getting more into fitness and nutrition, but there's some massive, you know, sort of adventure racing and things that people are sort of hitting the gym, you know, every single day, training for hours and hours. And it's, you know, that could also be just maybe a bit too much for the body. It's very, you know, quite highly inflammatory and requires a lot of nutrition to buffer the effects of that. And we just keep saying it's almost like just the extremes of everything. And as boring as it sounds, it's just everything needs to be done in moderation. So, you know, moderate amounts of exercise, just enough to be healthy, not enough to suppress your immune system. Like you said, a really nutritious diet, but don't go too far with it and just live on kale and green juices all day, because that's not going to do you any favours either. And same thing with the body composition. Yeah. You don't want to be, you know, sort of obviously carrying too much body fat, but also don't take it to the other extreme and start entering bodybuilding competitions and things.
Well, the thing is like if you look at, you know, kind of like tying in with what Keris is saying with regards to training and exercise, you know, a lot of the information that's out there in, you know, like the popular fitness magazines and on the internet and whatnot, and maybe even interviews you might see on the TV with athletes or sportsmen, whatever it may be, you know, when they talk about their training, their diet, their supplements, you know, it's always in relation to in season and things like that, you know. And what a lot of people don't understand is that athletes have an off season. Athletes do have downtime, you know, when they're recovering, and, you know, they're not just going hell for leather 24/7, you know, every day of every year. And I think people need to learn how to, yes, you can push yourself in the gym. Yes, you can enter races and set yourself some challenges, enter a bodybuilding competition, whatever it may be. But if it's at the expense of your recovery, then in time you will run into problems. And that problem may be injury, inflammation, potentially, adrenal fatigue, stuff that's going to really kind of throw you off track further down the line, which will be far more frustrating than kind of getting on top of your recovery now. And I think a lot of people make that kind of like bad choice of like train, kick my ass, instead of actually thinking, hold on a minute, is my nutrition supporting this? Am I sleeping enough to support this? And am I having enough downtime to ensure I can continue progressing at a rate that I'd like to?
Yeah, I think probably you're absolutely right, in because people will look at an athlete and see an athlete as the epitome of health, whereas we know that an athlete is what they do and the way they train and the way they support themselves, everything's geared towards performance in their event. But now if you look at most events, sports that athletes take part in, they're not particularly healthy. I mean, rugby, for example, not particularly healthy. Your impact, you're going to get all sorts of injuries. It's not, to be doing something like that regularly. However, we pay our money and we take our choice, don't we? So if someone is, we know what the risks are with, say, rugby and boxing and these kind of things, and these athletes look the part, they look like athletes, but it's not necessarily healthy for them to be like that long term. So... But I think if someone decides that's what they want to do, then that's fine. I think it's probably when people are ignorant to the fact and think that is the way to be. Like Michael Phelps, for example, I had a client say to me when I was advising them about they probably want to lay off the pasta. They repeated back to me about how much pasta someone like Michael Phelps, the swimmer, gets through. And I thought, it's not a proper comparison, this. And who says that he's healthy anyway? I mean, yeah, he's an unbelievable athlete who can swim and he's got talent like nobody else. But... you're not him, and that doesn't
You're
mean. I think that can sometimes
now,
be a bit confusing for people.
Start to
really
ditch gluten grains in their Porter Radcliffe is one of the first, wasn't she?
Yeah.
So we all know about obviously the distress running was causing her gut, and she started to say that she was going more towards a gluten-free diet, using rice instead of pasta, and so I think it is coming, because I don't think the body can necessarily cope with, the stress from the nutrition, the stress from the training, and I think you'll see more of it in future.
Well, if you look at, I don't know if you're a basketball fan, but there's quite a few basketball players now, you play in the NBA, the highest level in the world, who have adopted a more natural way of eating, and their careers are lasting even longer. Like, you just got to look at like Kobe Bryant, Steve Nash, both of whom are in their 30s, both who, a lot of people would have questioned some time ago whether they'd still be playing at this age. But, they all put it down to paying more attention to their recovery and cleaning their diet up. Whereas you look at some of the younger players like Dwight Howard, for example, I think he's, he's only kind of like mid-20s. Absolute beast. He's about 6'10" or something ridiculous, like lean, muscular. But he eats about, I think he's saying about 20 Hershey bars a day to kind of like keep his calories up and keep his energy up. Yet, I said, he's in his mid-20s and he's riddled with injury all the time. And he's, in an interview, he was talking about how, he can't remember the last time he was to know what it felt like to be injury free. Whereas you've got these older athletes, still very much playing at a very good level and performing week in, week out, who are still playing, their careers lasting longer, which means they can earn more money and ultimately they're healthier.
Yeah, it is. It's we'll find out, won't we? These guys will learn the hard way or not, and I suppose different people for different things. But it just shows, doesn't it, when someone, if they're doing well. I mean, obviously genetics comes into it again, but these guys are in an unrealistic situation, aren't they, in terms of the performance they're having to do regularly. And you do find with some athletes, don't you, that they seem to have terrible luck with injuries, and like what you just said there, maybe it's not the bad luck, it's something that they're doing, isn't it? So you know, they need to sort that out. Tell you what, I've got a couple of questions now, actually, that are quite, people often ask me this and what they, you know, it's quite relevant to the messages we get out in the public arena. Would either of you count calories or advocate counting calories?
It's funny because me and Keris both just looked at each other then, like, who's going to answer this? Because the thing is, we'll agree on most of this, but we might have a little bit where we disagree. So why don't you go first, then I'll go.
Okay. So what I tend to say to people first off is, you know, moving off processed foods and exercise, getting people exercising, it's quite big changes in your life. A big thing we also focus on is getting people to sleep more. So for about a month, and for some people, that this may be all we ever do, is get them to make those changes and make them habits that they do on a daily basis. And that can be really stressful, like cooking your own food, sourcing your own food, for especially for men. some guys I've worked with, I've ended up logging onto like Ocado for them and doing the shop for them, them it, and trying to just show them how to do a basic stir fry and stuff. And so for some people, and the changes happen really quickly, and you know what, that was enough information to take on board, and they're pretty happy with it. Then you do have other people who might be training for maybe like half marathon or CrossFit, women who have a fertility goal perhaps, or perhaps maybe a history of disordered eating. With them, we might start to talk through, and again, it would probably be in like a second or third month of working with them. Let's look at your basic metabolic rate. Let's look at your calorie expenditure. You can only ever, whatever anyone says, I still think you're only getting a rough idea. There's a big margin for error of a couple of hundred calories, but I do think there's a bit of an argument for checking in, because when a lot of people come off processed foods, there can be a big drop in calories, and they may not just recognize that. And for women, that can really compromise fertility. For guys, you know, it might be that they're not able to put on mass that they're looking for. And then we sort of play around with macronutrients, but if you try and do all that in one go, it's really overwhelming, really confusing, and people just focus on the calorie side of thing and start to ignore the sleep that we talked about, and start to I always think with calories, it does drive people a bit more towards processed foods, even if it's healthier ones, because they just want to have an effortless way of counting calories. They might go to prep for lunch because all the calorie counting is done, rather than taking their own lunch and stuff. So Matt, I don't know if you've got a different take, but
no, I mean, everything Keris said was like bang on, and I think it's, and I'm sure you'll agree with this, buddy, is that it totally depends on the client, you know, in that some people have got so much going on in their lives, like Keris said, the last thing they want to be doing is tracking their calories and their macros, because you know their life's stressful enough. But again, as generally, if we're working with someone who has got quite a substantial amount of body fat to lose, generally them just replacing calorie-dense foods for nutrient-dense foods alone will see them lose body fat, because they physically can't consume as many calories as they were in the first place. And so that's all we'll need to do with them, you know, very, very basic stuff. Whereas when we're working with leaner individuals who still maybe want to lose a little bit more body fat, by a matter of maybe 2-4%, for example, that's when we might need to dial in a little bit more on their calories and their macro split, and kind of just see where we can make some changes there. But again, it totally depends on the client. Like, for example, you know, if we've got a client who works with, I don't know, like numbers every day and spreadsheets, is maybe an accountant and absolutely thrives off of figures, then we probably know that if we was to say, right, this is your macro split, we don't want you to go above 2,000 calories, they'd probably love it, you know, and it's just all in a day's work for them, looking at numbers and pie charts and God knows what else. Whereas, like I said, someone else might absolutely hate the idea of it. And something that we do on our online plans is we actually ended up splitting our online plans into a level one and a level two for that exact reason, because we found that trying to educate people on kind of replacing the kind of like calorie dense for the nutrient dense foods, as well as other lifestyle changes, as well as macros, as well as calories, was just all a little bit like too much information. It was kind of information overload for people, and they're actually finding it quite stressful. So we changed it so that level one was exactly what Keris mentioned. It was that level one is no calorie counting, no macro counting. All we want you to do is just eat better quality nutrient dense foods. Cut out caffeine, cut out dairy. So it's essentially a 28-day elimination diet, purely so we can kind of see how their body responds. And then after 28 days, they've laid a nice healthy foundation, got insulin levels in check a little bit, and then we can advance onto level two. For those that want to, that's when we can look at calorie intake, macro split, blood glucose monitoring, et cetera, just taking things up a gear, so to speak.
Yeah, because I think probably for most people, I think what the calorie situation has done has confused the issue, and I think it ends up where people end up focusing on that at the expense of everything else. And as we know, it's not so much the numbers as to what the calories are, like you say. So, you know, calorie dense, you could be eating, you know, 1,000 calories worth of sugar compared to 1,000 calories of something decent. And for a lot of people, they wouldn't appreciate the you know, 1,000 calories is 1,000 calories. They would see it as that instead of appreciating what the food actually is. And I think that's probably where the damage has been done from the point of view of the calorie situation. But yeah, if you're going to have to go into more detail, then there comes a point, doesn't it? They're not insignificant calories, but I think they've caused a fair bit of bother when people focus on them solely, at the expense of everything else. Yeah,
and it gives, they like to think that they're in control, but what I just say to people is, if that formula worked, why are we in such a mess? Because now more than ever, we've got the ability to know exactly how many calories go in, how many calories go out, in that we've got all these devices to track, and it's not working, and everyone knows it's not working, and people try it for years, and it doesn't work. So,
As much as we'd like to make things simple, that is too simplistic to say, you know, hey, if my BMR, or you know, I'm burning 2,500 calories a day, if I eat 2,000 calories, great. I'm going to be in deficit to 500 calories every day, and then, you know, in a week or whatever, I'll lose a pound of fat. You know, if only that was the situation, we'd have an easy job on our hands, because you could just prescribe people that and then, you know, they'd lose the weight. But, you know, if only it were that simple. And I think that's probably what's caused, you know, like you just said, it's clearly not working. So, but some people persist, don't they?
Yeah.
Last thing, actually, what about what kind of exercise would you, for example, Kerris, what kind of exercise would you say is beneficial for females? Like Matt, I think we probably appreciate, would you agree that for most men, most men have the idea that doing the weights, doing resistance work is the thing that's going to get them where they want to get. But I think perhaps maybe women perhaps don't think that, and they're in the situation where they perhaps think they need to be doing lots of cardio.
Yeah.
What would you say to that?
Well, Karen? You know, it's really interesting, because I was lucky in that I started training. God, it's like, how old am I now? 15 years I've been training myself. So I tried a lot of stuff anyway. So I think women appreciate it when you feedback from your own personal experience. And one of my big things I say to women now is, find something that you enjoy, and try and mix up your training across the week. So ideally you want a combination of, when I recommend cardiovascular, I'm not talking about, because you know, women are notorious for loving that and thinking it's the best fat loss tool ever. I think it's more to do with the fact that it's such an endorphin producing way of exercising, and you know, who doesn't love that? But I think hormonally women just maybe need that hit a little bit more. And I have that feedback from most of my female clients, that they feel so much better going for a bike ride and a run than they do a weight session. So what I tend to say is, you know, cardio is fine if it's just done in a way that, one, you enjoy. So it can be a bike ride with your mates, a walk with your dog. It can be, you know, a gentle run, or if you're training for a race, obviously it's just going to be part of your program. But then to combine it with, as a minimum, I say at least one weight session a week, so that you're, you know, supporting joint health and building some lean body mass. I think most women benefit from probably at least two sessions of something like that. The other craze that's come about now is this is HIIT training and interval training. And whilst, yes, it's really effective as a fat burning tool, again, what I tend to do is, as Matt was saying earlier, we look at the person and it's just the right tool for that person. Because if someone is so stressed, working long hours and not sleeping well, HIIT can just send them, the interval training, high intensity interval training, can just be too much for their body. And what they're needing really is some lovely long walks outdoors and some yoga, as boring as that sounds, and that's probably going to improve their body composition more than anything else, because it's going to have a positive effect on their hormones. So and again, we sort of do this over time. So in the first month, again, it might be more about, you know, let's just get your nutrition right and just start to have a chat about the training. And if there's too many sessions there, we bring them down. If there's not enough, we take them up. But if someone can find something they enjoy, and often with women, I recommend things like boxing, gymnastics, dancing, where you're a bit more focused on mastering a skill.
Yeah, Olympic lifting, and all the ladies.
Olympic lifting, yeah. So it's more about, because women can be also very hard on themselves and very competitive in a gym environment, which isn't always that healthy. So if you're focused on learning a skill and not sort of how many reps you're doing compared to your neighbour, or how fast you're going compared to your neighbour, which is what a lot of these classes sometimes can do, I think that can be better for women. And we often get that feedback of, yeah, do you know what, I'm really into boxing and Olympic lifting. And, you know, it's more about, it's more mindful for one, so that they're more sort of enjoying actually just moving, rather than sort of setting themselves targets and numbers and you know, too many goals to sort of achieve in a session.
Yeah, and probably a bit more efficient insofar as the amount of time spent doing it.
Yeah.
And you can have these weight sessions that don't have to be particularly long, and create, like say, a massive benefit of generating some lean mass, which is what we're all really after, isn't
yeah.
it? You know, that's even though people, whether they know that or want, when they say they want to tone up and lose weight, the most popular statement from anyone at the gym is what they're trying to do is build lean mass, isn't
Definitely,
it?
Definitely, yeah.
Excellent. Well, I think that's a great place to wrap it up. So thanks a lot for joining us, guys. Some really useful information there. And, you know, hopefully we'll...
Yeah. Anytime, buddy. Just give us a shout.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot.
Awesome. Take care, mate.
Bye-bye.
So that was Matt Whitmore and Chris Marsden of Fitter London, authors of the book Fitter Food, A Lifelong Recipe of Health and Fat Loss. I would really recommend checking that book out. It's a real excellent resource with some very, very useful information and also some... you know, some excellent recipes, which is actually not that common that we get these books with real decent recipes made for the British market. They're quite more common we see them made for the American market. So yeah, check that out. Thanks for listening. If you would like to get in touch, ask any questions, I would ask you to visit the Ian's Health website, which is ianshealth.co.uk. You can leave messages for us on Facebook, that's Ian's Health, or Twitter. Till the next Ian's Health podcast, keep being healthy.